I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. My great joy today to welcome John Ortberg as my conversation partner. John is a senior pastor at Menlo Church in Menlo Park, California, and he's been there for a number of years. He's a person whose background was shaped by Wheaton College and by Fuller Theological Seminary. Not necessarily everyone knows that he has both a Master of Divinity degree from Fuller and a doctorate in clinical psychology from Fuller as well. He was for some time on the senior teaching staff of Willow Creek Community Church in Chicago. He is now in Menlo Park, and he also serves, with full disclosure, on the Board of Trustees of Fuller Theological Seminary. John, welcome. Thank you so much for joining Conversing today.
I'm honored to be able to do it. Thank you very much for having me, Mark.
John, when I have heard you tell stories about some of the early influences that shaped you as a Christian in your deeply Christian home and the attention and care of your parents, I've always just been moved by that, and then also moved by the trajectory that that set up that led to some surprises as well. So let's start with, describe a little bit about your earlier Christian influences when you were a child and still at home under your parents' tutelage and the formation of your early Christian experience.
I grew up in Rockford, Illinois, which is a little outside of Chicago, and loved growing up there. I ended up marrying a California girl who believes that Chicago is a stupid place to live.
Especially because it's so cold, I think I've heard her say.
Cold and flat, no mountains, no ocean, kind of like Gothic and Iron and flattened everything out. And she could generate a number of ideas.
Yes.
But for me, Rockford was the kind of community where folks could get to know each other well. There were many strong, active churches there, so it was a place where faith was often quite easily a part of life. And both my parents were followers of Jesus, and we were involved in the life of the church from my earliest memories. I was just talking to somebody about this recently. I can still remember when I was 7 years old, I had been to church, and that was back when we used to have church on Sunday morning and then again on Sunday night. And we'd gotten in the car, and I just had this very strong sense that I want to ask Jesus to be part of my life. So my dad and I went back up to the senior pastor's office and knelt down. And, you know, there is only so much you're able to understand when you're 7 years old. At the same time, I do have a distinct memory of a sense of God and wanting God. And so that was part of the journey for me. And then in my growing up years, I was part of a Baptist church in Rockford and felt like I was able to be grounded in the scriptures and develop relationships with friends. And there were always numerous adults who would be pouring into those of us who were growing up in that church. Mm-hmm. And it's the kind of thing that Kara Powell and the team at Fuller Youth Institute now do a lot of research on. But I would have been very much a recipient of the spiritual benefit that they have kind of chronicled. And so I was very grateful for that.
When you eventually landed at Fuller, was that out of an expectation that you were pursuing psychology or theology? Because you did both degrees at Fuller. What did you think at the time that you entered, and then how did that develop?
Well, I'm a very, very strong P on the Myers-Briggs, and so keeping options as open as possible, as long as possible,
yes,
is a deep part of who I am, and I'm a little surprised. I'm not even sure that I've made my final career choice yet, and I'm 61 years old now. So Fuller was actually the one place at that time where somebody could go and get a doctorate in clinical psychology that was approved by the American Psychological Association and get a Master of Divinity at the same time. And so that was very appealing to me. I did not know what direction I would end up going in terms of work. And probably when I went there, if I would have guessed, I would have said the most likely outcome would have been that I would go in the direction of some sort of clinical work.
And then something changed about that. Tell us about that.
I did some clinical work. And it turns out that I wasn't good at it. So it was
fairly clear.
It was very much learning about vocation, not by getting a postcard from heaven, but just by experimentation.
Well, it's good to get these things clear that it would probably not have been good for you and probably not for the people that you would have seen. So what's amazing is that your ministry then, I think of it as being a ministry that has flourished in a highly public setting of teaching, and where part of the strength of your preaching ministry, though, is a sensitivity to human experience, to the nuances of individual lives, to the uniqueness of people and their circumstances. So while it may be that you didn't end up being a clinical psychologist, it certainly seems to me that your preaching and teaching ministry reflects a kind of human sensitivity and compassion, nevertheless, that is one of the things that distinguishes your teaching.
Well, I do think part of why I was drawn to those two areas is that the questions in life that always seemed the most interesting to me and always seemed to be the most important pretty much meet at that intersection. Mm-hmm. What is the human condition? What does it mean to be a person? Why is change so difficult? How is it that change takes place? Mm-hmm. What does life look like when somebody is flourishing? It's always felt to me like there's lots of other questions in life that are probably worth pursuing and looking at, but these are the ones that really matter. And so I think both just the deep interest in those questions and then the opportunity at Fuller to be able to study in both fields and just learn about the nature of psychology. What are the journals? Who writes about what? What are the questions? What are the areas for research? What are the frameworks that you can have for thinking about things like attitude and habit and the mind? Mm-hmm. You know, all of that stuff became very much a part of understanding and learning that then would inform preaching, you know, without even particularly thinking about it. Mm-hmm.
Now, there are lots of people that I think have been influences on your life, but one of the people that surely is one of the most distinctive influences was Dallas Willard. When did Dallas become part of your own reading life, for example, and or your own friendship, which eventually emerged over time? Tell us about that, because it feels like one way of describing Dallas's work is that it's concerned with a lot of the same central questions that you've just described as your own.
Yeah, Dallas himself actually was almost a psychology major, ended up a psychology minor as an undergrad. And had I known, actually, in many ways, a lot of the questions that I was most interested in are as much or more questions that philosophy deals with as they are either theology or psychology. So I think that's very true.
Yes.
Yeah, for anybody who's listening to us that does not know, Dallas Willard was for many decades professor of philosophy at USC and a brilliant guy. Probably he and David Hubbard were the two smartest guys that I have known. And I will sometimes joke about Dallas. I would never get into an argument with him because I would be afraid he would prove I don't exist. I had been a pastor now full-time for a couple of years. I'd graduated from Fuller. And I was at a conference when somebody mentioned a book by Dallas Willard called The Spirit of the Disciplines. And I knew who he was because folks who were Christian that were doing philosophy were people that I was at least interested in, you know, knowing who they were and trying to learn a bit about them. So folks like Rich Mao and Lou Smith and Al Plantigan. So I had heard of him, but had not read anything by him. And so I got a copy of the book and flew home. And as I began to read the preface, it was very arresting for me. The initial thoughts were a burden about the church, that the church has failed to take transformation as seriously of an issue and a challenge as do modern revolutionary movements. And then what's needed for the church is to clarify and exemplify realistic methods for human transformation. And then Dallas lays out the thesis of that book, which is that authentic transformation really is possible if we're willing to do one thing, and that is to arrange our lives around the practices and rhythms that Jesus engaged in to be constantly at home with and receiving power from his Father. And when I had read just a couple pages of the preface of the book, I was a bit aware that there was somebody who had thought really deeply, much more deeply than I had, about the questions that I had, and that there was wisdom about them that was available from people across the centuries that for whatever reason I had not been aware of and that could become accessible. And so that particular book, The Spirit of the Disciplines, outside of the Bible, has impacted me more than any other book. And there are many passages in it that I have read literally 30 or 40 or 50 times. And it was, for me, in many ways, opening doors into rooms that I just did not know were there.
Right, right. When is this happening in your life, John, that encounter?
Yep. I would have been maybe 32. So I finished at Fuller when I was, I think, 29 or 30, and I was working now full-time as a senior pastor at a church. And I think part of what prepared me for that book having the impact that it did was I was now outside of school and working full-time as a pastor and feeling frustrated both at my own lack of spiritual growth, about all that I knew that I was supposed to do was to read the Bible and pray. And so I would work at doing those things, but I didn't feel like they were leading me anywhere. I didn't feel like they were having the kind of impact that I wanted them to. I didn't feel like I was getting to know God better or that I was changing in ways that I wanted to change. And then as a pastor, I felt like, I know I'm supposed to tell people, come to church, read the Bible, pray, but I don't have confidence that that's really creating the kind of change that gets talked about in the New Testament in my own life, let alone for the church that I'm serving, and I don't know where to turn. So it was really, I think, and I think this is often the case for people, a deep sense of frustration over years in my own life that prepared me to leap at what looked like it could have wisdom around those kind of questions and problems.
So for those who don't know Dallas's work, what was it about that trigger that is the difference between read the Bible and pray versus yield your life to conform to the rhythm of Jesus's practices? Tell us a bit more about that. What is Dallas advocating?
So I'll say a little bit about Dallas and then a little bit about what he's advocating.
Okay.
After I read that book, I wrote him and told him what an impact it had had on me. And it turns out I was living in Simi Valley, and he lived in a place called Box Canyon, which was just 5 or 10 miles away. And so he invited me to come over to his house and talk. And I did. And he lived then, his wife Jane still lives, in this little house behind a white picket fence outside of the San Fernando Valley in Box Canyon, California. Almost no furniture, just books all over the place. And you know how a lot of times you might read somebody and their writings could be really moving, but then when you meet them in person, they might be a little bit disappointing.
Yes.
And with Dallas, it was exactly the opposite. I mean, I'd never read words that had impacted me like that, but his life was better than his mind. And he lived in an awareness of the reality and presence of God like I had just not experienced before. And he was not perfect by a long shot. I think he could be passive. You know, he would say of himself that he wrestled with contempt, but there was basically no hurry in him. And not only did he not gossip, when you were with him, you didn't gossip. Because the only reason to gossip is you get a little charge out of the other person's response to it. And that just was not in him. And there was very little fear or anxiety in him. And so I was very intrigued and motivated when I read the book, way more so after I met the man.
Right.
And if I was going to try to describe the difference between the way that I had thought previously and what Dallas helped me enter into, I'd say before then, I did not have a meaningful or robust, for lack of better words, theory of change. I didn't understand how engaging in certain devotional practices, like reading the Bible or praying, were to be involved in bringing about the transformation of a person. I had almost just not thought about it in that way.
Yes, yes.
And one of the ways of talking about this, it doesn't get at it comprehensively, but Dallas would sometimes say there's an enormous difference between training to do something versus trying to do something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for people who are listening to us right now, if you just think about it on the physical level, how many people who are listening to us would be able to go out and run, not walk, but run every step of a marathon if they try really, really hard today? And probably most folks couldn't. But probably most people listening to us would eventually be able to run every step of a marathon if they wanted to, if they were willing to do one thing, and that is to train. To train means I arrange my life around those activities through which I receive the power to do what I cannot now do by direct effort. And as a general rule, transformation in any significant sphere of human life involves training, not just trying.
Right, right.
And that's true when it comes to music. You know, if you want to play Beethoven, it will be really difficult if you just sit down at the keyboard and get a score and try really, really, really hard.
Right.
But if you arrange your life around practicing scales and learning music and so on, eventually you will be able to do what you cannot now do by direct effort. And that's true of the intellectual life. And it is no less true when it comes to the spiritual life. So Paul, for instance, says to Timothy, train yourself unto godliness. Or Jesus says to the disciples, no disciple is above their master, but every disciple, when fully trained, will be like their master.
Right.
And so that notion that following Jesus does not mean just trying really, 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 really hard in the moment to be more patient or more joyful or so, that there is a way to arrange your life, and it will involve certain practices, sometimes called spiritual disciplines, and then other dynamics as well, being led and guided by the Spirit, certain experiences, like the experience of suffering or cross-cultural events and so, through practices and relationships and experiences, transformation can actually be pursued. We don't do it. We're not in charge of it. It comes by the grace of God from moment to moment. But there is wisdom around it. There is an order to it. People have discovered that in previous eras, and it always lies available to us. And so that understanding that following Jesus means not just making sure I get to go to heaven when I die, and not just that I engage in certain devotional practices because you're supposed to, but it involves discipleship, that is, arranging my life in such a way that I can be present with Jesus and receive the power from him to become like him. That was something that I'm sure many people had talked about well, and I should have known, but did not.
Mm-hmm. So let's just put that on hold for just a second. I want to come back to it. So you are, in this period of time, you're serving as a senior pastor, and it's from there, is it, that you're called to Willow Creek. Is that right?
Yes. Well, actually, I was at my first church, and then I was at a second church for about 4 or 5 years, and then from there I went to Willow Creek.
Got it. And when you went to Willow Creek, were you called there as a teaching pastor?
I was,
yeah.
Yep.
So now you've had this experience of the impact of Dallas. You've pastored 2 churches as senior pastor. Now you're going to a church that is on the fast-track rise of being one of the largest churches in America. And you have now this Dallas/Jesus-formed vision of a new and different kind of discipleship than you might have thought before. Now, when people stand on the outside of mega churches in America, it often feels like it's platform-centric, not discipleship-centric. And I would say that when Willow has been at its best, it has been discipleship-centric, and that it really has tried to be a training place. I think many, many things about the way that Willow's life has been structured has been trying to aim in that direction. But as you went from these pastorates into Willow Creek with this new Dallas Willard-like paradigm, it feels, candidly, like it's a bit of a countercultural voice in the context of a mega church growth pattern. Or maybe it wasn't. So talk to us about how you brought those two things together as you went to Willow.
Yeah, it was a very vivid difference because I went from a church plant to Willow Creek, where there were literally more people on staff at that church and the association than there were in the whole congregation that I had been to previously.
Right.
And so I have been in, you know, small churches and large churches. And just purely speaking from my own experience, I would say I have not found small churches to be more disciple-oriented
mm-hmm.
or disciple-centric than large churches.
Yes.
I would find in general, they probably, pastors will tend to spend the same amounts of time working on preaching
mm-hmm.
and possibly doing pastoral care.
Mm-hmm.
And so
right.
just in my own experience, I don't think that a smaller church lends itself more to disciple-making activities than a larger
mm-hmm.
church. And again, disciple-making, and disciple is one of those words that we throw around a lot. Precisely one of my problems before was, you know, I knew people should read the Bible. I knew people should be praying. I didn't have an understanding of what's the way of life of a disciple.
Yes.
And I actually find AA to be a very helpful group to learn from. We may get back to that later on. But I would say when I went to Willow, one of the strong suits of Willow that was often less understood from on the outside than it was from the inside was it was a culture where the call to total commitment to Jesus was extremely high. And when I went there, there were actually part of the rhythm of the life of the church was that there would be services on the weekends that were geared for people to invite their seeking friends to, and then services in the midweek that were times of worship and teaching from Scripture, and that's where I most often taught, that were geared towards people who already had made a commitment to Jesus. And that not just the freedom, but the expectation that the congregation there would be called to a deep devotion to Jesus and commitment in their time, commitment in their servanthood, commitment with their mind, commitment in their behavior, commitment of their work, financial stewardship. I would say that kind of culture of calling people to full devotion as followers of Jesus was very, very robust there. So for me to talk there about the kinds of things that I learned from Dallas, there was a great openness to it. And in fact, we had Dallas out numerous times to meet with staff and leadership and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that the receptivity level to it was enormously high.
Mm-hmm.
I think the primary challenge at Willow around it would be the same challenge at almost any church, large or small. And I think it is the great challenge of discipleship today. If somebody comes to a pastor and says, you've convinced me, I have decided that becoming like Jesus is the most important thing in the world. It is worth giving up everything else. So I'm in. What do I do?
Right.
Now, in AA, somebody can tell you exactly what to do. And it's not legalistic, but it's concrete and it's transformative. I think the great need in, at least in much of American Christianity that I'm familiar with, is to have as much clarity about what's the way of life for a disciple that AA has around what's the way of life for a recovering alcoholic.
Right.
And I do think it was a challenge at Willow to try to implement that, but I think it's the same kind of challenge at the church where I am now, and it would have been the same kind of challenge at the, you know, very small church that I was at before I went to Willow.
I'm Mark Laberton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. So having come now to Menlo, after how many years were you at Willow?
I was at Willow for 9 years, and I had been at Menlo now for 15 years.
Right. And Nancy, your wife is happily in California, and you're able to surf, and you're able to be in a warmer climate, and it has hills and mountains and other things, so that's all good. But as you've now obviously long since adjusted to being in the Bay Area, you find yourself pastor of a church in one of the most influential parts of the world these days, right at the very core of Silicon Valley. Many, many, many people in your congregation are at the heart of that reality as it's unfolding throughout the peninsula in the Bay Area, but also the whole Bay Area. And it extends far, far beyond that. So talk to us then about this ongoing work of what does it mean to lift up this kind of, I'll call it an AA-oriented, plain-spoken, practice-centric life of becoming like Jesus. How are you trying to encourage that, not least in a Silicon Valley setting?
Well, you know, one of the great advantages is I'm just across the bay from where Mark Labberton used to be and preach at First Press Berkeley. So the fragrance lingers. And I got that going for me, which is nice.
Yeah, that would help.
I would say this involves a deep sense of calling, longing, and frustration for me. Probably the dimensions of such a ministry that come most naturally to me would be thinking, writing, preaching, communicating on it. And so on that front, I think I work at it quite a bit. Identifying and clarifying and embedding a way of life that actually does involve realistic methods for human transformation has been much, much harder. And it's something that I will talk about with our staff here. We're actually in the process right now of seeking to put together what will be involved probably a series of teaching from a preaching standpoint, but then also curriculum material for small groups to go through and those core practices or ways that can become a framework for somebody who is a follower of Jesus to use on a regular basis. We are working on that. I just had a meeting around that yesterday. So we are working on that currently. Yes. Periodically, we will invite people into good wisdom around those issues. So I would have Dallas Willard, when he was alive here, periodically come out and teach. We've connected with Renovare, which is an organization that Richard Foster has been involved with around spiritual formation. We're actually talking with Fuller right now about formation groups for our staff. We had a couple of people just having conversations around that yesterday. So we are continually looking at how do we try to identify or create best models that can help make discipleship as a concrete way of life accessible to people. I think that not only for us, but for the church in general, that continues to be a work in progress. I do think one of the challenges is, you know, when Jesus was around, becoming a disciple was real clear cut. You just physically follow him around. And so you knew if you might not be a good disciple, but you know if you're a disciple or not. And then after his crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension, there's the Acts 2 church. And their way of life gets described in the book of Acts. They devoted themselves to the apostles of teaching and prayer, the breaking of bread. So as a community, they have such a distinct way of life that it's very clear to people, here's what I do if I want to be a disciple of Jesus. And then over the centuries, as the faith spread in the Roman Empire, you get to the time of Constantine where it's now a majority faith. But part of what that means is the actual way of life, the practices and rhythms and so on, has gotten so diluted that it's hard for people to find a way of life that has power in it. And so then you get Anthony and eventually others going into the desert and trying to find again a way of life that is transformative. And, you know, so then you will get rules of life, ways of life. And that just goes on periodically. And I think one of the difficulties for us in the U.S. is we still live in a society and a culture that is in many ways marked enough by Jesus and is kind of churchy enough and kind of Christian enough that there's often not that real clear-cut sense of I'm going from non-disciple to disciple. So I think that search for how do we make living as a follower of Jesus, being a disciple, as effective and clear in the church as the 12 steps are for the AA community, I think that's the single great challenge opportunity for the church today.
So it's really attempting to figure out what is the way of Jesus that can actually be described and then articulated and practiced as tangibly as people that are in the 12-step programs experience.
That's exactly right. And of course, part of the irony is the 12 steps and that way of life in AA did not get started as a method for dealing with addiction. It got started with something called the Oxford Group, which was begun by a Lutheran pastor named Frank Buckman, and was simply an attempt to recapture the practices of the early disciples. In fact, it was initially called a first century Christian fellowship. And so all of those core practices, learning how to do self-examination, deeply honest confession of struggles with other people, as well as storytelling, meeting together regularly for accountability in a small group, taking the message. All of that came directly from people trying to recapture what does it mean to be a disciple of Jesus.
Right.
And it just turns out that with Bill W. and Dr. Bob, they stumbled into the Oxford Group. And for the first 3 years, about 30 or 40 people found their sobriety, but there was no AA. There was just the Oxford Group. And then eventually that stuff gets codified and kind of adapted for alcoholism specifically. But it is interesting where it started was simply a group of people who were trying to live as a disciple of Jesus. And oh, by the way, that way ended up being able to deliver people from addiction to alcohol. And one of the sobering questions in that is, if somebody comes to my church and they do church the way that we tell them to do church, they do discipleship the way that we tell them to do discipleship, do they as a byproduct of that receive the power to be delivered from an addiction?
Right. I think one of the things that's interesting about all of that to me is that when I wrote a book a few years ago entitled Called, The Crisis and Promise of Following Jesus Today, the first part of the book is really about this sense of recovering a call to be a follower as our principal vocation. And that often what stands in the way of it is kind of the thing that I call the ecclesiastical industrial complex, just this whole sense of churchness that is thick and that a lot of pastors devote enormous amount of time to church, and they may or may not devote nearly as much time to the clarity around what does it mean to cultivate a community of people that are seeking to be earnest followers of Jesus. I think that there's been periodically throughout history renewal movements that have tried to reclaim that. And one of the things that I'm very aware of in the Bay Area is that since I moved away from there 5 years ago, and certainly about 9 or so years ago when I left Berkeley to come to Fuller, I have become very aware of the way that it feels to me like there's a lot of renewal going on in churches and in new church movements in the Bay Area. And so I want to come to that because it feels to me like one of the really interesting things about the work that you're doing is on the one hand, you have this longstanding historic congregation. It has grown before you got there, then it grew even much more significantly since you've been there. It's large in its scale, it's multi-site in its reach, and it's deeply evangelistic as well as disciple making, I think. And it's happening in a time when I sense a lot of fresh openness and change. So here's this cynical Bay Area, extremely low attendance, one of the regions of the US that's never had a spiritual revival. And yet I would say there are sort of the early signs of a kind of revival that is going on in the Bay Area. And it intersects now, I think, with both what's happening in the city of San Francisco on the peninsula and really around the Bay. Your wife, Nancy, of course, is very involved in this, in a movement that she's helping to lead entitled Transforming the Bay with Christ. But just talk to us about the cultural moment that you see in the Bay Area and this spiritual transformation that I think is quietly but significantly unfolding.
Gosh, those are just wonderful words, and I find myself inspired as you're saying them, Mark. Yeah, I think in the Bay Area, there are a lot of conditions to set people up for a hunger for God. it's a place where there's a lot of energy and a lot of opportunity. Mm-hmm. A lot of people come here because they want to impact the world, and that's a good thing, although it's easily sidetracked into grandiosity. Nobody moves to the Bay Area for relationships. People move here for money or opportunity, and that means that there are a lot of people who are quite isolated.
Yes.
And those larger networks, family systems, and so tend to be not robustly present here.
Right.
It's a place where it tends to be a very high performance culture. And so everybody wants to be successful and look successful, only without appearing to try hard to be successful. And so just about an inch under the surface, there's divorce, relationship breakdown, addiction,
fear,
emotional challenges, desperation, fear, anxiety. And then it's a place where there tends to be a high value on learning and education. I have a friend down in Orange County. He says, in Orange County, everybody wants to be the most beautiful person in the room. But in the Bay Area, everybody wants to be the smartest person in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the challenges that the church faces is it has a reputation amongst many people who are secular in the Bay of not being thoughtful, that
right.
somehow something has been proven that shows that Jesus and his message are no longer a viable alternative. And then it's often thought to be a thinly veneered political organization.
Yes.
And a lot of people who put themselves in the none of the above religion category would be people who believe in God or are prepared to believe in God, but they tend to be progressive politically, and so they think the church is just out as an option for them.
Yes.
All of which is to say, I think when there are churches that are prepared to talk about Jesus and his message in a thoughtful, informed, respectful way, and create community where people can find relational connection and where they can find meaning and where they can be open about their pain and find healing, I do think there's a tremendous hunger for that. I think that the dynamism of the city and people's longing for the city and the work of folks like Tim Keller, who's kind of named that and targeted it and helped to resource young leaders who want to be a part of spiritual revival. I think all of that stuff we're seeing is going on here in the Bay Area quite intensely.
Yes, yes. Well, I think it creates a hunger, an exposed hunger, as you say, sometimes thinly veneered, but it's not difficult to find the hunger in the Bay Area. And I think you're right about what it is that causes people to be drawn to the peninsula or to Berkeley or to San Francisco. All of it is drawn out of those same kind of instincts that you're describing. And I think if we understand a big gospel, a robust gospel, a deep gospel, a personal and interpersonal gospel, that gives us resources to bring to exactly that kind of a place. And I just want to bear witness as a person that now doesn't live in the Bay Area, that it seems to me that God is doing a lot of new things in the Bay Area. And it's hugely encouraging to me to see, because it's a place of such opportunism and opportunity, and yet confusion, lostness, loneliness, pain, all of it is there. So it's one of the reasons why your own personal ministry there is such a joy to me, because it feels like it's an expression of a kind of gospel that I think is exactly the right voice, the right person, the right context at this moment. So thank you for all you're doing. When you think about the challenges, though, of being a leader, when you sort of stand back, not just now thinking about your setting and the peninsula, but the crisis that the American church is in right now, and if you were to speak more broadly about what are the leadership challenges or opportunities of this moment, what are the main things that come to mind for you in that?
I don't know that I've ever formulated it exactly like this before, but I would say it is a crisis in leadership, broadly understood, and particularly in attracting great, thoughtful young leaders into the service of the local church as their life vocation.
Mm.
I think that people want to have an impact on the world. People want to make a difference. And while that can get junked up by sin and get attached to the desire for power or reputation, in itself, I take that as part of being created in God's image and what it means to exercise dominion, the desire to make a difference and mm-hmm. to add value. Mm-hmm. I think part of what we're seeing happen is an increasing belief or awareness or perception that if you want to make a significant impact on the world, on culture, on human flourishing, being the pastor of a local church is a decreasingly likely way to do it.
Yes.
And so as we look at who are folks where that drive to make a difference and have impact are really strong, and if we were to measure decade by decade over the last century or so, what percentage of those people are drawn to devoting themselves to the life of the local church, my guess is it would be a decreasing percentage. And a friend of mine who's a church historian was telling me in 1951, 10% of all Phi Beta Kappas went into the clergy. Hmm. And today it's far less than 0.1%.
Right.
And so that would just be one data point
right.
that would suggest the church is not drawing into its leadership the caliber of folks that the church really needs to be able to flourish. And so, you know, it's a very complex issue and lots of dynamics that are connected with other dynamics. But I would say the single biggest challenge would be the need for lots and lots of young Mark Labbertons to say, I will devote my life to seeking to build up the Church of Jesus above all else.
Mm-hmm. Well, all this is one of the reasons why I'm so grateful that you're on Fuller's board, because clearly as we as a board and as an institution try to grapple with this very challenge that you're naming, we have to ask ourselves, what is our role? Part of it has to do with what are we prepared ourselves to do to help this and not to hinder it or to confuse it or clog it up? But how do we also strategize and retool ourselves in such a way as to be able to both attract such people and also provide along the way, in the appropriate way, the kind of education formation process that's going to really truly equip people for the kind of ministry that you've been describing? And as you know, that's one of the great challenges of theological education right now and of Fuller. If you were king of the forest and you could remake Fuller or theological education in America today to try to achieve or contribute to this goal that you're describing of attracting great, thoughtful young leaders, what would you do?
Boy.
The keys are yours. Tell me.
That's a fabulous question, Mark. I wish I had a clear answer, and I don't. I would pray for Mark Labbertin.
Please do
being
that.
Being in the role that he is in. I think that building thick communities where people gain vision and inspiration and encouragement from each other has great power. Mm-hmm. Michael Lindsay, who's at Gordon, wrote a book not long ago about called Faith in the Halls of Power, but just about kind of evangelical leadership over the last few decades. And I think it's often been drawn into the marketplace, and I think that's wonderful, and we're seeing interest in faith and work explode, and I think that's great. Ultimately, I don't think any movements like that can be sustained apart from flourishing local churches.
Yes.
And so I'd probably want some people who are themselves terrific leaders and who can be magnets for great emerging young leaders, to be putting them together in cohorts, to be identifying mm-hmm. where are flourishing churches mm-hmm. that can become magnets for such young people, and how do we put them together so that they can be getting to know each other, encouraging each other, cheering each other on, and actually doing kind of hand-by-hand combat and doing that recruitment work one person at a time.
Right. I do think that it comes out of what you're just describing. I'm struck by your words, thick community, because I think when I look back on how did it happen that I ended up becoming, not so much becoming a Christian initially, but certainly growing as a Christian and ultimately discovering what I thought my own gifts and calling were to be, it did emerge directly out of thick community that has really lasted for decades. Some of the same people that were influential in my life 40 years ago are still influential in my life today. And that kind of deep continuity of vision, community, belief, affirmation, discipline, accountability, all those things that become the platform for a sort of vision that's much greater than just here's a job that could be done. And at least when I've heard you describe some of the people that influenced you at Fuller and before Fuller, but also including people like Dallas, that becomes a really different platform from which you are emerging as a leader than would be true of many people that come out of thinner contexts, I guess I would say.
Yeah, I think there's no question when I look at my life, so many people, and so many of them were Fuller Seminary people like Dave Hubbard and Lou Smeads and Max Dupree and Ian Pitt-Watson and Neil Warren and Richard Gorsuch and on and on and on and on, Roberta Hestenis, were people who stretched me, challenged me, inspired me, made me look at their lives and their minds and their work and think of what wonderful things there are to do and what doors God wants to open for people who are willing and say, yes, this would be a noble thing to seek to do with my life. I think the need for another generation of those kind of folks is probably greater today than it was when I was young.
John, one of the things that I want to say as we close is just how, again, how much I respect you and how grateful I am for you and for your ministry and how much I think I've learned from watching you and being inspired and challenged by your gifts and your personal integration. I think also I want to just say I've always been struck by the degree of preparation that I think you give to many of the things that you do that some people do more glibly that I think you have often done with so much greater care and research. And the difference between those two things is really quite striking to me. And I think it's partly why the sense of the intellectual engagement that you have, the spiritual convergence that you're seeking, I'm not trying to suggest that you any more than anyone has arrived, but I just want to acknowledge that those are qualities that I think really distinguish your ministry, that you are also a guy with a great sense of humor and a kind of naturalness that is present is a pretty wonderful combination. But there's another quality that I want to highlight for some of you who don't know, a ministry that John and I both have had longstanding commitments to is International Justice Mission. And recently that ministry celebrated its 20th anniversary and in part a ministry that they've had that's a response to human trafficking and people who have been enslaved in various forms, of which 47,000 have found rescue in the 20 years that IJM has been in operation. And in the closing ceremony of this wonderful weekend that we had celebrating and giving thanks to God for the work of IJM, John was asked to bring it to a close. And you did a really wonderful thing that I think of as a John Ortberg touch, which was there were about 4,700 people at the gathering. John had us, if you can imagine, a huge arena filled with 4,700 people. And so as he was bringing it to a close and we were wanting to honor Gary Haugen, the founder of IJM, in a way that really was not about Gary, but just lifting up the fruitfulness of the ministry, he said that he invited all of us to raise our hands and to extend our 10 fingers, each finger representing roughly one of the 47,000 people that had been rescued by IJM. And in silence, in this arena, we all stood and raised our hands and wiggled our fingers in acknowledgement of the individual meaning of all of these lives. And it was not just that it was a clever move, which it was very clever and wonderful. It was much more than clever, it was profound. And this brings us back to where we started the conversation. It's this combination of the value of the individual and the reach of God's global purposes. And I think God has given you, John, a special vocation as a leader to help the church lay hold of those things. And that gesture, as practical as it was, as symbolic as it was, as emotionally powerful as it was, landed in the value of each person represented by all the fingers represented, but also the value of a aggregate work that is really the sum of what God is doing through IJM around the world and obviously by extension through many, many other organizations and churches and people. So I just say thank God for John Ortberg, and I'm really grateful for your ministry, thankful that you're on our board, that you're my friend, and that we've had this conversation. So thank you very, very much.
Well, you have been my teacher and leader of an organization that I'm a part of and a pastor to me in moments when I very deeply needed a pastor. So everything that you said right back at you, and thank you for the joy of this conversation.
You have been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.